Hello and welcome to season 4 of Medical Women Talking. My name is Jane Dacre and I've been privileged to listen to the career stories of these inspiring colleagues. These women have all made an impact and many of them have overcome barriers in their careers. From them, you will learn that we all have setbacks and barriers in our careers, but what defines us is how we cope with this, which is part of life.
Hello, everybody. Today, I'm talking to Professor Wendy Byrne, who's a well-known psychiatrist with an interest in the elderly, and she's a former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Wendy, can we start off by you just telling me about your career and how you became a psychiatrist? Could start as early as you like and tell us whatever you like.
Okay, so the story started when I was 2. I decided I wanted to be a doctor when I was 2. Both my parents were doctors. My father was a reluctant doctor. His father had kind of forced him to do it. But my mother was really passionate and enthusiastic and loved medicine. So I decided when I was 2, I wanted to be a doctor. I was always interested by how the body functions and how illness changes that. So I did the sciences at school. I was actually, I mean, maybe there were already early indications that I'd end up in psychiatry because I was actually more interested in the arts and I was better at the arts. I was good at English at school, but I did the sciences because I knew that I wanted to be a doctor. Went to medical school, had a bit of, had a problem there. I failed the first year. I really struggled with the anatomy. Anatomy was really hard for me. And also I got distracted. I got involved in the university theatre group, had an absolutely wonderful time, but ended up failing the first year. Had to resit it, struggled through. And after that, it was a bit easier. Second year, we did sociology and psychology, and I loved that. So again, maybe another clue to the fact that one day I would end up in psychiatry, although I didn't think of it at the time. Did enjoy my psychiatry placement as a medical student, got a lot of positive feedback, got given responsibility, and found it really, really interesting. But still at that point, wasn't really thinking of it as a career. And then in those days, once we'd qualified, we did 6 months medicine and 6 months surgery. And during that year, I discovered that what really interested me was not actually what was going on in people's bodies, but what was going on in their minds and how they reacted to their illnesses. So at that point, I began to think about psychiatry. There was quite a lot of stigma against psychiatry. I mean, there still is now, but there was more then. It was worse. And when I spoke to my supervisor and said I wanted to train in psychiatry, he said, "Well, Wendy, you're a good doctor. You don't have to do psychiatry." and interestingly, I still hear similar stories now. There still is the stigma against it. And I wasn't sure. So I did a 6 month locum. In those days, it was all much easier and more flexible. I did a 6 month locum in psychiatry, loved it. And never looked back. A similar sort of thing with old age psychiatry. I didn't think at the beginning that I would want to do it, but really loved my placement, and then chose to do that as a higher trainee. And again, I've loved it. I love working with the elderly, and it does keep that aspect of medicine there. I see quite a lot of, obviously elderly people have quite a lot of physical illness as well, so it just keep you in touch with that side of medicine as well.
Interesting. So from talking to you before, I can remember you talking about having quite a wild time in your first year at university, but in the end it didn't hold you back. But was it the first time you failed an exam when you failed your first year?
Yes. So, I went completely off the rails. So I'd been very good all the way through school. I'd studied, worked hard. My only kind of outside activity was I was a member of the St John's Ambulance Brigade. So we used to go off, I used to do a lot of training, and we used to go off every weekend and go to horse shows and grass track races and things, and pick up the people who fell off the horses and fell off their motorbikes. So I hadn't actually had a lot of fun. And that first year at university, I don't regret it. It was actually the best year of my life. It was just fun. And then the artistic side of me, you know, working with the theatre group, I didn't act, but I kind of helped with, I guess I was a stage manager. Yeah, that's what I was called, and I helped find the props, and I just loved it. So although it was bad, and I was very lucky to get back into medical school. I had to do an appeal, and I was just honest and said what had happened, and they let me back in, gave me a second chance, which I'm really, really grateful for. And after that, I stayed on the rails, but I was still involved with theatre group. I still did have a bit of fun through the rest of the university.
Well, you know, on reflection, being off the rails for a bit broadens the mind, doesn't it?
It does. I became an anarchist as well for a bit.
You're an anarchist?
I was an anarchist for a bit, but they were so disorganised that I gave up with that. Yeah.
So anarchy is too disorganised.
It was too disorganised, yeah.
So throughout your career, you talked a little bit about stigma. Has it all been plain sailing?
Well, the stigma that attaches itself to psychiatric patients does stick to psychiatrists a bit as well. I started off doing psychiatry in Southampton, which was where I'd been a medical student and I'd done my house job. So I sort of knew everybody there, so it wasn't so difficult. But it was interesting when I moved to Leeds and I would kind of go and see people in A&E and come into contact with other specialties. Yeah, there was still the stigma there. I think it's a lot better than it was, but there still is a stigma, and you don't really mention, like, if I'm in a taxi, I've given up saying I'm a psychiatrist in a taxi. I had a terrible taxi journey where the taxi driver asked me what I did and I said I was a psychiatrist, and then he started telling me about his suicidal thoughts and how he was thinking of just driving his taxi into a wall with whoever was in the back. So that wasn't good. So I tend not to say what I do.
You probably didn't want it to be you.
I didn't want it to be me. I just wanted to be anyone. I was advising him to get some help.
and in career terms, did you just sail through, or were there times when you had second thoughts or had any trouble?
Well, there were always things where it didn't go well. The first time I stood for an election, when I was a trainee, I stood to be a trainee rep at the college. The college has a really strong trainees committee, and I stood to be a trainee rep and didn't get elected. And then I thought, oh, well, that's the end of my political career. So not everything always went right. But I think, you know, the great lesson is, if something doesn't work out, just keep going. Don't be put off. There was always something driving me forward. I don't really know what. I think it was about really trying to change things for patients, and it just wouldn't let me rest. So I'd maybe apply for something or try and do something and not be successful and think that there was still this inner thing pushing me into positions where I could actually try and change things. And within the training, my first step on the ladder was actually sort of accidental. I'd just become a consultant in 1990. And somebody stopped me in the corridor and said, the youngest consultant or the most newly appointed consultant becomes the college tutor. So you need to be the college tutor. And that was how I took my first step on the ladder, really. I became the college tutor. There was no job description. There was no payment. There was no interview. I just became the college tutor. And I wanted to do it because I'd just finished being a trainee. I knew about the problems that trainees had. I thought that I would be able to change things and to support them. And then I just kind of worked my way up, little steps within the training structure. Did a little bit of time as management. And I do say to people who want to be leaders, try and do a bit of time in management, because management it's quite hard, isn't it? You're not just being a leader in management. You have lots of different things to balance, and more of a having to do what you're told, I guess. But somebody said to me, a wise manager once said to me, doctors find management difficult because there are no heroes in management. And I think it's good to just spend a bit of time there. So I was a manager for a bit, but not for too long. Mostly I just went up through the postgraduate education route. And then I set up the first school of psychiatry in Yorkshire and became head of school, which was great. I loved being head of school. And then the position of dean came up at the college, and I stood really on a bit of a whim. I did not think I would be elected, and was very surprised when I got elected. So that was my first national leadership role.
Fantastic. But then from there, well, you presumably enjoyed your time there, because from there you were elected to be president of the college.
I loved being dean. Lots of people have been dean and president, and everyone who's done both says being dean is best. And being dean was, I really liked being dean because I had a national role and national influence, but it was still education and training, which is, that's what I like doing, education and training. And the whole time I was dean, people kept saying to me, will you stand as president? And I always said, oh no, I don't want to be president. It's all about politics. I'm not interested in politics. I don't know why I thought I wasn't interested in politics. It's about power and money, isn't it? But
it's interesting. Yeah, because you were saying that you thought your career was in ruins when you were a trainee and you didn't get elected to a committee. And yet there you are later on realising that perhaps you were interested in politics.
Yeah.
So tell me about the transition.
Yeah. So I've never said no to an opportunity. And in the end, that's why I had to go for president, because otherwise I would be turning down an opportunity. Again, I was kind of half hoping I wouldn't be elected, but I did get elected and became president. And yeah, that was a massive step up. As you know, you've been a president, you know the responsibility, the meeting. I mean, I knew nothing about politics. I really hadn't been interested. But one of the members of staff at the college took me to the three different party conferences. And when you've been to the party conferences, then you understand politics a lot better, don't you? It also tells you what your party is when you've attended the conferences.
So what did you learn? What did you learn about politics? Very vital lessons, I would have thought. What did you learn?
I learned it was about money and power. But I also learned that if you're there representing a college, really representing a group of patients, what's really powerful is patient stories. So you can go and have a meeting with a minister and you'll have been briefed with all sorts of statistics and figures. But if you tell them a story about a patient that you've, and I'm still, throughout this, I've done clinical practice. As president, I only managed a day a week, but I was seeing patients a day a week. And if you tell a minister a story about a patient, they understand that and they get that, because MPs meet people, you know, they have surgeries, they meet people in their constituencies, they understand about problems and they see what people are facing within the NHS. So I learned that was a very powerful way to influence.
So did you have favourite stories? Are there any particular stories that influence more than others?
Well, they were real stories. So I probably, I used to change them a little bit, but they were pretty real. And I did used to say to the ministers, this has to be confidential. But they were mostly about people who couldn't get what they needed because of the problems in resourcing.
And was it impactful? Can you think back to an example of where you told a story and then something changed as a result of the story?
Well, who knows? It's all little things, isn't it? But we did have the NHS long-term plan while I was president, and mental health got a good chunk of funding for that. And I like to think it wasn't just me; it was the whole college team. We were all working on it. We had the whole policy department working on it. But that was favourable to mental health, and I do like to think that was partly my influence.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. So. You said you don't really know why you've done all of the things that you've done, but what inspires you? What makes you feel like you've done a good job? What keeps you going, gets you out of bed in the morning?
It's this really wanting to help patients and really disliking any kind of injustice, or so often bureaucracy gets in the way of what we do, doesn't it? And I really hate that. And that was one of the things that I like doing with trainees. Often with a particular trainee, you could solve some bureaucratic problem that was stopping them from progressing. And I hate it when there are unintended consequences. So a real live example is at the moment we have a kind of target of so many people who are referred to the memory service. I work in the memory service now 2 days a week. And we have a target that a certain number of people who are referred must get a diagnosis within a certain time. Now, I've got a few patients who don't have a diagnosis, but I think might end up with one. So then I want to see them again in 6 months. I want to say to them, you haven't got dementia, but there's some worries here. So I'd like to see you again in 6 months. Now, they show up on the system as not having a diagnosis and therefore distract us from the target. So I'm trying to sort that out at the moment, and that's the kind of thing that keeps me going, that the idea that I might have to discharge somebody who really needs a bit of follow-up, and it's only like you know, half an hour of my time in 6 months' time, not a big deal. But the idea that the bureaucracy and a target might stop that working, then I like to try and change things. So I like to change, well, fight systems when they have unintended consequences, which is all the time.
Yeah, and the targets have become quite problematic, haven't they, and drive peculiar behaviours.
Yeah, overall they're good. I mean, overall it's great, and we've had a lot of investment, but it's just when they go astray, and then sometimes, and so then I like to try and go back to the root of it and see if I can change the target a bit or talk to the commissioners.
Fantastic. So can I change tack a bit and talk a bit more about you as a person? Because as well as having a stellar career in psychiatry, you've also got interests, got a family life, got children. How was that going along in parallel? Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so that was hard. When I was training, there were still not many women around. So I was actually the first woman psychiatrist to be appointed in the hospital where I worked. There weren't many women around, and they didn't like the idea of you having children and going on maternity leave. So all through my training, I said, I don't want children. I'm never going to have children. And then I got my consultant job and then got married almost immediately and then got pregnant very, very
So were you
quickly.
Were you fibbing, or did you actually think you didn't want children?
Yeah, I was fibbing. Yeah, no, I always wanted children. But I knew that if I said that, or I thought, no, I think it's true. I think if I'd said that, people wouldn't have been. Who knows? Sometimes you can think these things and they're not right. But that was my perception, that it wouldn't be well received. And nobody had ever, there hadn't ever been anyone on maternity leave. No psychiatrist where I worked had ever had maternity leave. So it was quite a big thing. And then it was hard managing. But I was so lucky in that we got a wonderful nanny. I had my son first and then my daughter very soon after, and we had a wonderful nanny who joined us when he was born, and actually she still works for me because neither of us can bear to part, so she's the cat nanny now.
Brilliant. Sort of, I mean, in those days it was kind of easier to get a nanny, wasn't it? I think for young women with small children these days, childcare is a hell of a burden. It's quite difficult, isn't it?
I don't know how people manage. I don't know how people pay for it. I mean, even in my day, it took a substantial chunk of my salary. I would say to people, it's really worth it because, you know, the children do, it feels like it'll never end when you're in it, but actually they grow up really quick, don't they? And then they go off to school and everything gets a little bit easier, and you do make up the earnings later on, so it's worth struggling through. But I don't know how people manage. I've looked at the costs of childcare now, and they're scary. I didn't want to use a nursery because you've got to get the child out of bed in the morning and get them to the nursery, haven't you? And if they're ill, they can't go. So I was, but I was very lucky in that I found a wonderful nanny, and my parents moved to be near. So I grew up in the south, moved to Yorkshire, and then my parents, when they knew I wanted to have children when I got married, they moved up here. So they were really helpful. But it was I look back on it and it was really tough.
Yeah, and various things like school shows and what have you are a complete nightmare,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, an absolute complete, yeah, the whole of life was a bit of a nightmare. It made me very quick. I'm still very quick. You know, when I look at my productivity compared to other people, I get through a lot of patients, and you had to finish. I mean, because we had a nanny, she was really good and she would stay late, but I couldn't, she was doing long hours. She was doing 8 till 6. I really didn't want to ask her to be doing more than that. So I had to finish at 5 to be home at 6. And I got good at making speedy decisions and doing things quickly. I got good at time management.
I got that. Yeah, it does make us efficient, I think.
Yeah.
And also your partner, I mean, it's quite a burden on the rest of the family, isn't it? You have to have so many people feeling well for you to be able to get to work in a day.
Yes. Although it did tend to be my responsibility, but I think that was how it was then. And, you know, men take a lot more responsibility now. I mean, my husband took, there was no paternity leave there. He took half an hour's paternity leave with our second child. He picked me up from the hospital at 4:30. and that was it. And
is then he a what doctor?
Happened? He's a doctor, he's a radiologist, yeah. And then what happened was that his colleagues all started having babies, and then he was expected to cover them for no money. So they were going on maternity leave. He was having to work long hours for no extra money. And that was, I think, when that happened for the third time. And obviously we had to pay the nanny extra. Obviously she stayed late. And then when they were at school, there was a real problem if you didn't pick them up. I think when it happened about
well,
the third time.
You are supposed
time,
to pick your children up from school.
Yes,
you know,
you are
somebody's
meant to pick them up
from
school. Yes, somebody's meant to.
It's not a good look if they're the last on the carpet.
It's not. First in and last out is not good. So I think when that happened to him about the third time, I said, look, you're going to have to insist on being paid a bit for doing all this extra work so that at least we can pay for the childcare.
Oh, God, I know. I remember those days. Complete nightmare. So what do you think's helped you to thrive really a lot along the way? What characteristics or what events have helped you to thrive?
I think I was very lucky with my parents. So they were, you know, they were really good. And I think they really, a lot of your self-esteem comes from your parents. I also think that my psychotherapy training helped a lot. When I was a trainee, I had quite a lot of analytical training. The trainees now don't get so much of that, but I had quite a lot of that. It was there, it was available, and I took up the opportunity. And I really think that helps you. It makes you more resilient, so that when patients get angry with you, you understand why they've got angry with you. When things go wrong, you have a bit more insight into why. So I think the psychotherapy training really helped me. I mean, nowadays balance groups are getting more popular, aren't they? We had balance groups when I was training. Now there are more of them. Anybody who gets a chance to go to a balance group, go, because that kind of thing, that helps. And then some of resilience is just, you're born that way, aren't you? You're lucky.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. A lot of the women that I've spoken to, a lot of them are prepared to work very hard, but a lot of them have just got that, well, okay, let's just get on with it.
Women, but a belief in you and yourself, and you pick, you know, when things go wrong, you pick yourself up and you try again, you keep going.
That does seem to be quite a common theme. So looking back over your career, and with the benefit of hindsight, of course, is there advice that you might give to younger women who are coming through, who are wanting to have a career in psychiatry and or leadership?
Work hard. Don't get to know that working hard. I mean, you mentioned hard work, and there is a lot of hard work, isn't there? It's not just opportunities, don't just kind of fall at your feet. So work hard. Take every opportunity, you know, stand for election, apply for that job. If you don't get it, if you don't win, it doesn't matter. You can just keep going. So seize opportunities as they come up. But also, I think be true to yourself. Have a kind of set of values and morals. Be clear in your head why you're doing things. And in the end, it is for the patients. That's what we're here for. And anything that you do should have at the heart of it, trying to make it better for patients.
That's really lovely, and lovely point on which to finish. So thank you very much, Wendy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.